We'll give everybody another minute to kind of come back and settle in. But while we're waiting, I want to really quick remind folks that Earth Day is coming up here very, very quickly. And I'm going to try to weave just a little bit of kind of an Earth Day theme into the talk today. But the Interfaith Power and Light organization is having a live stream this Wednesday. So if you are so inclined, I encourage you to join that live stream on the 22nd, which is Wednesday, from noon until 2. And they're titling this A Call to Collective Care. And it feels to me like a beautiful way of working with the Earth Day theme during a pandemic, right? And I think increasingly we're seeing, especially as part of our Buddhist community, how these interfaith threads, the way we work with our neighbors and friends who have different faith traditions, is more important arguably now than it has ever been. Any friendly human connection is more important now, perhaps. But we know that our faith traditions undergird so much of our worldview and our understanding of what life and death are. So connection to the earth and connection to each other, connection to other faith traditions is of great import right now. So if you are free on noon this Wednesday, give that Interfaith Power and Light live stream a shot. The links to all that stuff is on the MZMC Facebook page. So if you got questions about that, you can check it out there. So it looks like everybody is back. Most of us. I see people trickling in. So good morning. Thank you all for spending part of your Sunday with us here at virtual MZMC. It is wonderful to see all of you. I am titling my talk today, Ornaments of Buddha. Ornaments of Buddha. It's something I've worked with, a phrase I've worked with for a long time, and I'll get back to that here in a minute. When we're at MZMC, as many of you know, we usually have a program that we give out to folks as they come in for the talk. And that program has a quote on it, oftentimes, that's picked by the speaker. And so I know you do not have a program in front of you, but I'm so habituated to coming up with a quote that I have done so, even though it didn't occur to me. Oh yeah, they're not going to actually have a program. But I just decided to choose something from Ecclesiastes, the book of Ecclesiastes in the Christian Bible, again, because this interfaith work is very much on my mind right now as we are together in our suffering. And so the passage I'd like to read, chapter 1, verse 9, goes like this, and a lot of you have heard this. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. So there's a lot of places we could take that. It hits me in a sense as a description of samsara. I'm sure that wasn't the intent, but it reminds me a little bit of the way that in Buddhism we talk about cycles of suffering, cycles of life and death, cycles of grasping and attachment that we are caught by, stuck in, until, of course, we do something to change consciousness, to begin to see and repair broken patterns. At the same time, it seems to argue with our central Buddhist idea of change, constant change. There's nothing new. A Buddhist might argue, no, that's the opposite of what's true. Actually, everything is new all the time. And I think that that's true. I actually think both these things are true. What it does, though, for me, is what a lot of Buddhist scripture does, and that is take me out of the immediacy of the circumstances of my life and remind me of the dimension of the eternal. And if I think of the eternal as the wave of constant change that the particle of my life is part of, or if I think of the eternal as the unchanging, either way, it has the effect on my mind of reminding me that there is another way of perceiving the reality that I'm living through, right? So in some ways, in many ways that are very real and I think very tangible, very physically palpable for all of us right now, we are living in and through a circumstance we've never encountered before, that we as a species have never quite encountered before. I think that's fair to say. I think that helps to validate our confusion. I think it helps to validate our fear, our sense that there wasn't a blueprint for this. You know, there wasn't an owner's manual for what to do when this was to happen. I think that validates a lot of our anxiety. And at the very same time, I also think it's fair to say that Ecclesiastes is right. There's nothing new here. And as Buddhist practitioners, we may agree, because if you think about it, as Buddhists, this is sickness, old age, and death. There's nothing new here. Impermanence, nothing new here. This is the human condition, right? This is the beginning of Buddhism, the four passing sights, the acknowledgement of the suffering that is inherent in sickness, old age, and death, the origin of the Dharma. This is the base of our entire practice here in the human realm, right? The inevitability of change, the inevitability of suffering. This is the fuel, right? These are the guidelines on our path, as practitioners. Impermanence is kind of the whole thing. So we get to ornaments now. Katagiri Roshi, said life and death are the ornaments of Buddha. Life and death are the ornaments of Buddha. We know life and death is a way of talking about that samsaric world, right? The samsaric cycles of suffering. And we know that Buddhism offers us a way free of that stuckness, right? So when Katagiri Roshi talks about life and death being the ornaments of Buddha, you can sort of feel, can't you, that he's showing you two different sides of the whole. Life and death being merely the ornaments of the Buddha, the clothes that Buddha puts on. Kind of like the earth puts on the clothes of spring, you know, in the form of flowers and blooming thing, and then it puts on the clothes of winter as we just are emerging from now, right? The white garments that she wears. We sort of can imagine that some of this is about change and some of this is about something that is permanent and abiding. So sickness and old age and death are the ornaments of Buddha. They are not something separate from Buddha or things that we feel we need to overcome to get to Buddha, right? This is Soto Zen. And so we have the identification of samsara and nirvana, the non-separateness of suffering and liberation, right? So in a Zen sense, we aren't expected to transcend and leave. We are expected to embrace fully. And then the duality we create between samsara and nirvana is overcome, right? Our gassho. So all of this beautiful earth, I'm looking out my window here, especially this time of year, right? All of its life is an ornament of Buddha, part of that life and death. Earth Day and Buddha Day, kind of the same thing. The coronavirus pandemic, an ornament of Buddha, part of life and death. And yet, of course, we prefer life to death. We prefer no pandemic to pandemic. Of course we do. And as Buddhism teaches us, when we prefer our angels to our demons, we are still in the weeds. And as Dogen says in Fukan Zazengi, if there is the slightest discrepancy, then heaven and earth are rent asunder, made separate. Something that is inherently whole is made separate. And he also says, and despite our preference, flowers fall, and despite our aversion, weeds spread. So here we are, none of us preferring pandemic, and yet it is the ornament of Buddha that we are part of, as our life and death is an ornament of Buddha, and as those things are non-separate. That is our preference. We still prefer the blossoms to the weeds. What I've noticed about myself in the past couple of months especially, something I've noticed before but is really showing up at the fore for me, is how mercurial my preferences actually are. My preferences are impermanent. Right? The thing that I really strongly prefer today, I may not prefer tomorrow or in a month or in a year. And so I've been doing kind of a thought experiment, and you can do this too if you wish. The thought occurred to me that if I, in this imaginary thought experiment world, if I somehow knew with absolute certainty that I would never again experience the emotion of sadness, right? Most of us agree sadness is an aversion. We don't want it. And when it's there, we wish it was gone, right? So my imaginary thought experiment was, what if you knew for certain you would never experience that emotion again, ever? You would never experience the very particular texture of the emotion that we call sadness. Do you imagine that you might miss it? It's an incredibly fundamental part of being alive. Every human being experiences the texture of sadness. What if you were actually deprived of that? What if my preference was indulged by the universe and somehow I knew I would never experience sadness again? Right? That intrinsic and inescapable human experience suddenly gone. I wonder if I might long for it. I actually wonder if I might long for it and if I would imagine that I would prefer sadness to not sadness. And I do the same thing in my thought experiment with the emotions of anger. The way it burns and the way I wish it wasn't here. And confusion, right? It's cloudy texture. It's scattering nature. And fear, the emotion of fear or anxiety, its sharpness, right? The electricity of fear and how it galvanizes our attention and clenches our gut and tightens our chest. What if I knew without a doubt I would never, ever, ever again experience one of those emotions, those central parts, those pillars of the human experience? Might I miss them? I imagine that I would. It's a funny thing to imagine preference in that way, but I actually imagine that I would long for the thing that I now call suffering if I was forever deprived of it. So I have been making a list in my head, and I think what I'm going to do is write them down at some point, because I'm in the midst, as you all are, of social distancing and sheltering quarantine, doing most of my meetings virtually, doing a lot of stuff on the phone, wearing a mask in public, stuff that would have been utterly bizarre to me 6 months ago. And I find myself, like a lot of us, longing, right, for this to be done, wishing that this were done. So I started to imagine, what about this that I'm experiencing today? As I'm speaking with you, right? As I'm giving a Dharma talk from my house. This is where I sit every day. I usually face that direction, you know, the wall. But today I'm facing this way. Wow. What about this experience that I am living through? We are collectively sharing, all of us. What about this am I going to miss when it's gone? And what I've been surprised by is I'm having no problem coming up with a list. There's actually a lot about this. I'll be grateful it's gone. And there's a lot about this that I'm actually going to miss. There's a lot about this that I'm actually going to miss. And not all of it is pleasant. But there's a certain number of things in my life that are forced into my awareness now that weren't before, right? I've thought a lot in the past month of Katagiri Roshi's famous, I think it's famous because it's famous in my head, toilet paper is Buddha, right? He's famous for riffing on the old koan about the stick and saying your toilet paper is Buddha, you know, you treat everything as a Buddha. I'm going, wow, well, perhaps as a nation, in our hoarding frenzy, we're figuring out, oh my God, toilet paper is Buddha. It's changing the way I relate to simple objects like that, right? My breath. I notice I'm present to my breathing in a different way when I'm wearing a mask, right? I find it unpleasant because I'm not used to wearing a mask. I'm not used to having the humidity reflected back to me. And I also realize when that's gone, I may actually miss it. I'm present to my breathing in a very different way. It's so immediate now. Perhaps because of its newness, its novelty, but also perhaps because the exhalation is immediately reflected back at us, right? So we're feeling even something like that in a different way. The way we relate to our food, the way we relate to our packages, the way we relate to our neighbors. So anyway, it's just an invitation. It's a thought experiment. What about what you are living through right now? Will you miss? I think that's actually worth doing. I say that because this seems like one of those things we're probably going to talk about the rest of our lives. There's a pretty reasonable chance we'll be telling our kids and our grandkids and our neighbor's kids and our neighbor's grandkids about this in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. This is just one of those things. You live through this very unusual, very intense, very strange thing, and you'll be telling stories of it. And isn't it funny how when we tell stories of the past, even past suffering, there's that pang kind of longing. Oh, I almost wish I could live through that again. It's showing me how impermanent my preferences are. Right? What change? So back to the ornaments. The ornaments of Buddha are change. The ornaments of Buddha are non-abiding because, of course, everything is non-abiding. And before I started sitting meditation, before I discovered Zazen, I didn't know that each breath that I inhaled and exhaled was actually different. In fact, it was something I never thought about. I would have imagined that an exhalation is an exhalation and an inhalation is an inhalation, right? A breath in and a breath out, they're all the same. Same old, same old. And lots of experiences would have been in that same category. You drive to work on Monday, you drive to work on Tuesday, it's the same drive, right? You change your socks, you change your socks. No difference, right? You wash, to wash dishes is to wash dishes. To get the mail is to get the mail. It's the same experience over and over again, right? It's boring because you've had that experience already. And I imagine that if I could have fast forwarded, if I would have had a little bleeper that could have controlled the speed with which I was experiencing things, I would have fast forwarded over those experiences like they're reruns, right, of TV episodes that I had already seen before, and they were all the same. And you know where I'm going with this, because as meditators, you've discovered what I discovered, which is that's actually not true. That's actually not true. All of those different all those different breaths, that entire river of breathing that I have been wading in since I was born are different. Every sitting, every period of Zazen, you know this, is different. We see this especially during Sesshin or long retreat when you do sitting after sitting and then you take a break and sitting after sitting and you take a break and then the next day shows up and the schedule is exactly the same and sitting after sitting and take a break, right? And you would imagine that you're repeating the same experience over and over and over, and all of us who have done anything even close to that know that's absolutely not true. The last 10 minutes of a sitting are different than the first 10 minutes of a sitting. We all know that. Every moment is arising fresh. That's the invitation, right? Of mindfulness practices to begin to see the movements as change. Impermanence is a thing, right? The Buddha is right. Impermanence is the only thing, right? Because everything is change. Everything is change. And so we're always free. The implication of that is that we are always free. Like a lot of us, I have moments of feeling stuck right now, of feeling trapped. It's a state of mind. My freedom is exactly the same as it was 6 months ago. As an introvert, I prefer, generally speaking, to stay and to stay home. I would probably make choices that would involve me contacting other people much less than, let's say, my extroverted friends. And yet now that I don't have the choice, I'm experiencing what I would have volunteered for in a very different way, right? I just want to stay home, stick in by myself. That's great. Now you have to do it. Oh, hold on a minute. Maybe I want to do something else, right? Wow. My preferences are very mercurial. Here we are. So if you are present enough, and I trust that the most of you have a very regular and steady meditation practice where you get to experience this every day, you know what it is to be deeply and intimately present, right? To the fabric of your arising experience, the nature of your changing thought, the nature of your changing emotion, the nature of your changing physical sensation, right? That's what we do. That's what we get really good at doing. You already know then that everything we're talking about with change being constant isn't a hypothetical idea. It isn't a truism that Buddha gave us. It's actually the nature of our unfolding experience, right? We have never felt the exact same sad twice. The degree of stuckness that I may feel today is going to be different than the type of stuckness that I experienced yesterday. If I have longing today, it will have a different texture, a different length, a different intensity, a different size than the longing that I may have had yesterday. Just like your breaths, right? Each sad is different. Each happy is different. Each joy is different. Each sitting is different, right? This is the freedom of mindfulness practice. This is the freedom that it affords us. So I encourage you to watch and to especially non-conceptually feel, to really enter into the landscape of your next emotional state, right? When you notice, oh, I'm really noticing that I'm feeling blank, right? I encourage you to sit down for just a minute or two and do nothing other than let that emotional state wash over and in and through you, and to explore it as intimately as you do the texture of breath when you're doing zazen, right? Just keep watching it. Really, really feel it. No comments, right? No preference, like normal, right? We don't need to wish it to stay. We don't need to wish it to leave if it's pleasant or unpleasant. But just attend to it like it was your last experience. Bear witness to it like it was of immeasurable value. Like it was completely precious and it was about to leave and never return. That you would never again have that experience. That it was an ornament of Buddha. That it was change. Because it is an ornament of Buddha. And it won't ever come back again. It'll never return. You'll never have that one again, right? And if you're really present, you'll notice what we all notice when we're really, really present. That the texture of that emotion, the texture of that moment, dances and changes. Right? Under your loving gaze, it gets harder and softer and duller and sharper. It gets louder. It gets softer. It gets clearer. And then it fades. Like every breath, every emotion, every physical sensation, right? Tim was making reference to this in his latest blog post. Pema Chodron, the Tibetan Buddhist teacher, talks about this a lot, about how when we're deeply present to a single emotional state, we actually see they're much shorter than we imagine that they are, right? If we're deeply present to an emotion, we can actually watch it arise, do its dance change and turn into something else, or at least start including something else in a very short amount of time, 30 seconds, a minute. Some folks would even argue as long as a minute and a half, but I've never heard anybody say longer than 90 seconds. Some people say as short as 20 seconds, a given emotional state, before it turns into something else, before it starts getting duller or sharper, or starts including something else, or starts fading into something else, right? Wow. Talk about change, right? Nothing new under the sun. I'm just angry. I've been angry lots of times. And at the same time, constant change. I'm not stuck here. I'm in flow in the midst of flow, right? And I have always been flow in the midst of flow. So it's the same old thing again. Isn't that weird? Same and different, same and different. So these times that we are living through have a lot of difficulty in them, of course. That's happening. That's happening. Our invitation as Buddhist practitioners, as Zen practitioners, is to stop trying to escape, to stop resisting, to not deny, to not indulge. We know this. This is exactly Zazen. You don't grab on. You don't push away. Right? You don't say no, but you don't try to keep it. These difficult times are arising. These difficult times are passing. Right? Life is all verbs. Actual experience is always a verb. So these difficult times contain great moments of non-difficulty. These difficult times contain moments of great difficulty. And they are also not separate in any way from earlier times that we imagine were happier, nor are they separate in any way from times that will occur in the future that we imagine will be happier. They aren't even just times, really. We use that word and we make it sound like there's a discreteness. We are living through these times. That's true. It's conventional and it's useful. And yet it's also just the happeningness. It's also just the changeness of things. It's what you're experiencing now, right? Dogen teaches us that all moments are in this moment. They are separate and they are non-separate. And it occurred to me, it's a little bit like holding a book. This is just a metaphor, so it's not perfect. But it's a little like holding a book, you know? You hold a book as a whole. You hold the whole thing at once. And in that one moment of holding that book, you know, you are holding that sort of scene setting beginning, and you're also holding the introduction of the characters, and you're also holding their development and their evolution and their conflicts and antagonisms and struggles, and you're also holding the resolution, you know, and the ending. Those are all separate events, right? And all the little pages on which those things are described with symbols are separate, of course. And they're each integral and they're each essential. And they're still part of one book, and you're holding that whole book in your hand at one time. And you have no problem understanding that you're holding one book with many events at one time, and that when you're on page 50, page 20 is the past, and page 70 is the future, and you're holding all of it at one time. Right? All those different events are existing simultaneously for you, and you're holding all of them in your one soft hand. This is the space of Zazen. This is what we bear witness to when we do Zazen. The whole book at once, in one moment, held with a soft hand of our loving gaze, the gaze of our attention, right? So considering how much death we have experienced and how much death we are seeing, how much death we are hearing about, how much death we are experiencing or that we fear. I've also been thinking a lot lately about the saying, life is not killed, that I first heard from Tenzin Reb Anderson Roshi. Although an individual life ends, life is not killed. The particle and the wave, the relative and the absolute, the wave crashes into the shore and is gone forever, and at the same time, the ocean is just the ocean. Nothing has been lost. Life is not killed. I don't know if those words were offered out of the desire to comfort, perhaps. I don't imagine that if I was facing the death directly of someone that I loved, that they would be of comfort to me. I'm not awake enough yet to experience that as comfort. But I also understand that not getting caught in the particular is really important, right, as Zen practitioners, to remind ourselves of the dimension of the absolute, that space of Zazen that we talk about, where we hold the whole thing at once, and we see the big picture as well as the particular. Because we know life isn't limited. When we talk about just life with capital L, seems like an appropriate thing to talk about on Earth Day. We're talking about life when we're talking about Earth Day, the desire to protect life, to preserve life on Earth Day. It's an acknowledgement of our preference of life. It's also an acknowledgement when we look at the Earth that on this beautiful green and blue orb, life and death are happening constantly, right? And that life for the lion means death for the impala, right? And that life for the impala means death for the plant that it eats. And that life for the, you see it, this is part of one big dance. It's the ornaments of Buddha, right? When we talk about life with a capital L, we know we're not limiting that to a specific form of life, right? The plankton isn't less alive than the impala, which is not less alive than a human. This is life. It includes death. It is ornaments. It is the nature of consciousness itself, right? Flowering. How much a part of that we are. Dharma is the same way, right? The ornaments of Dharma. Dharma is the same way. It can't be limited to specific forms. It wasn't limited in our tradition to Pali or to Sanskrit. Dharma wasn't limited to Chinese. It wasn't limited to Japanese or Korean as it spread. It isn't limited to English. It isn't limited to French or German or any language it's now translated into. Dharma can't be limited in that way. Life is the same way. It evolves in ways that fully include, but they also transcend much of what we perceive as came before in its evolution, right? Life didn't stop with single-celled organisms or multi-celled organisms. It didn't stop at plants. It didn't stop at reptiles. It didn't stop at mammals. It didn't stop. It can't stop with us. How could it? Just as no one page of the book that we're holding can imagine the whole that it's part of, no one form of life can imagine the whole that it's part of. And again, we're no exception. We can't see all of it. We like to think we can. It's one of the great joys of being a human is just embracing our collective hubris. My God, we think we're important. We really do think we're at the top and we know all of it. That's funny. It's tragic and horrible, but it's also kind of funny. Life and death. Our hubris is one of the ornaments of the Buddha, right? So I want to wrap up here by reading for you a poem that I found online. It was sent to me by a friend of mine. And it was offered to us by a woman named Lynn Ungar, U-N-G-A-R, from her blog. She's got a regular blog on WordPress, and she wrote this a little over a month ago. A lot of people, as I know you've seen, are sharing art. They're creating art, and they're sharing art through the internet. It's one of the things that made my list of things I'm going to miss. When people are left alone, they become creative. And that fascinates me. Because people who wouldn't necessarily have imagined themselves as creative are discovering they are. Of course, we all are, right? So this poem was written about a month ago by Lynn Ungar, and it's called Pandemic. What if you thought of it as the Jews consider the Sabbath, the most sacred of times? Cease from travel. Cease from buying and selling. Give up, just for now, on trying to make the world different than it is. Sing, pray, touch only those to whom you commit your life. Center down. And when your body has become still, reach out with your heart. Know that we are connected in ways that are terrifying and beautiful. You could hardly deny it now. Know that our lives are in one another's hands. Surely that has become clear. Do not reach out your hands. Reach out your heart. Reach out your words. Reach out all the tendrils of compassion that move invisibly where we cannot touch. Promise this world your love, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, so long as we all shall live. I thank Lynn Unger for that beautiful offering. It sounds very Buddhist to me, although she's likening it to the Jewish Sabbath. In Zen, every day is the Sabbath, so we get to treat it as such. So that's what I'll end with. The acknowledgement that we all have that these are dark times and light times, right? Pandemic, no pandemic. Fear, contentment, ornaments of the Buddha. Life and death, ornaments. Right? Oceans and plants and lizards and cats, humans, sun, moon, earth, ornaments all. Fully included, fully transcended, each precious, unique, each no big deal. Each of no consequence. And each the whole thing. Including those present moment pages of fear, sadness, and confusion that you don't prefer. Those are the book of your life. They are the book of the whole universe. The book of Buddha. It's yours. All of it. Who else could it belong to? And since it's all here, now, fully revealed, the question is, how will you treat it? How will you treat it? I think that's as much as I have today. I thank you for your attention.